Guy James Show and Hit on Radio Network.
Here, now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, just 12 days now.
Thanks for being
12 days, and we are counting. Less than 12 days, actually 11 days and 19 hours to the end of the Bush presidency. It's hard to believe. Here in Washington, people are prepared for the onslaught, the crush of all you visitors coming to town to see the new president elected, or inaugurated, I should say. They don't know how many to expect. 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4 million. But they're making it as difficult as possible for those of us that are going to the inauguration to go. I guess that's understandable. They're closing down virtually the entire District of Columbia, at least the mall area and the downtown area. They're making sure there is no automobile traffic, motor vehicle traffic, anywhere in there except charter buses and taxi cabs. God, taxi cabs are going to make a fortune on Tuesday. Instead, we're all going to crush into the metro, which wasn't designed to carry this many people in, and force our way on into the bodies to get there. I will be among them. I don't know how I'm going to report to you on Tuesday, January 20th. I guess we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But I am prepared, along with several house guests, friends of mine from my California days, who are grateful to have the say. If you're trying to buy your way into Washington, well, it's not going to be easy. People have rented their homes for a week, I think it is, on Craigslist for $18,000 or $20,000 or some ridiculous amount of money. If you want to stay in a hotel, good luck. Not possible. Everything's booked. Everyone is ready. Obama will begin. In the meantime, have a new Congress.
America's number one Democratic talk show.
They're getting busy themselves. They are preparing to have hearings for all of Obama's nominees before he nominates them. Very good idea. Let's get something done in these 12 days before Obama
gets
and let's approve them all and get them in and get them running. Meanwhile, the question of who's going to be in Congress is, well,
I hope it's nice where you are, although it can't be better than this.
We have, of course, mostly the drama of Roland Burr
in
Illinois. And he, of course, was someone that...
Lots of traffic.
Nobody thought was going to be anywhere near the Senate in any time in his life.
Snowbirds.
This is the guy who was active in Illinois politics
and
in '79, in the '80s, but has run, I don't know, 20 times since then and hasn't won. And Governor Blagojevich indicted Governor Blagojevich, chose him purposely because, well, they knew that...
27 minutes from right now, we're
going
to have...
He knew that was somebody that... really wasn't going to be very popular. He's someone who hasn't won a Democratic election, even a Democratic primary, in a very long time.
We've had it on
but,
the program
well,
before.
Well, I guess all the typical things happened, and Blagojevich got the last word.
So we're
Harry Reid and every single one of the Democratic members of the Senate, all 50 of them, had told them they wouldn't seat whoever Blagojevich chose.
Do you have that same feeling?
Reid took that letter with all 50 senators signed and said, Blagojevich, don't choose anybody. Barack Obama weighed in and said that he didn't, Blagojevich, choose someone, giving that he has been indicted
for,
or at least arrested.
Big holidays. You know, we got
for
Valentine's Day coming up soon.
Selling that seat,
but
for making it pay to play for the
Thanksgiving Day and New Year's Day.
But
when everyone kind of
Blagojevich, as I said, he got the last word. He appointed Roland Burr, and you had the Congressional Black Caucus weigh in saying you've got to seat an African American. You had Congressman Bobby Rush, the same congressman, by the way, of Illinois, from the South Side of Chicago, that Barack Obama tried in 2000, a primary to a House of Representatives seat. But Denny Davis has been there that long, and of course he's the one who said turning Roland Burris away was something akin to Bull Connor or George Wallace. While that rhetoric was highly out of order, it was enough to scare the Democratic majority into seating the guy. What do I think?
But well, college football season's all over with, and tomorrow night.
I guess I think that they're not worth fighting in Roland Burris. They're not worth fighting. I understand why the Democrats said Blagojevich don't appoint anyone. I think they tried to scare him into not appointing anyone.
Time to put your nose back to the old grindstone.
But a governor indicted for criminal activity that could put him in jail for a long number of years. Facing an impeachment,
did you spend a ton of money
with only one card to play, that of the Senate card, it seemed extraordinary that he would not play that card. It seemed to me that Blagojevich, much like a suicide bomber, was saying, if I'm going down, all of you are going down with me. And once he made the appointment, well, the law is the law is the law. And Roland Burris was fond of pointing that out under Illinois law, as in most states, not all states, by the way, but about 30 odd states of the 50. It is the law that the governor, a point in the fact that prior to 1916 or so, under the United States Constitution, the Senate was the repository of the state's representatives. You understand that when the Constitution was first made, the House of Representatives, they represented the people, and the Senate represented the state.
The bank was tightening
the idea was, in the Grand Compromise, as it were, that originally on the Articles of Confederation, small states equal the big state. Small states only agreed to join in our Grand Compromise, in our Constitution, if they could have an equal representation in the Senate. That's why, by the way, Delaware, which liked the arrangement, was the first state in the Union. Rhode Island, which didn't like the arrangement, another small state, was the 13th state. A lot of people don't know that when George Washington became president, there were only 11 states in the Union. North Carolina and Rhode Island held out. North Carolina came in pretty soon thereafter. Rhode Island didn't join in until the Second Congress, the first Congress. Those 2 years of George Washington's first presidency didn't include Rhode Island at all. But Rhode Island finally joined in, and under the Grand Compromise, of course, under the House of Representatives, each group of people in the United States gets a vote.
In
so
my life,
every 600,000 citizens or so today get the vote. It was
probably
much
a whole
smaller,
lot tougher
course,
than last year.
The nation. But they divided it up, and the larger state will be inaugurated.
Bag, if you know
Senate
I mean.
Was two apiece. Two senators chosen by the state legislatures of the 13 colonies, later on the 50 states. Or the 48 states, I should say, because the rule changed in 1916. After 130 years of electing senators solely from the state legislatures, the Constitution was amended, and we've had direct election of senators ever since. You may be interested to know, just while I'm on the historical bent here, that 58, and even though most observers believe that he handily won those debates, he still lost his seat. He did not become an Illinois senator. He was no more than an Illinois state legislator, just like Barack Obama. He did not win his seat because the state legislature chose Douglas over Lincoln. So he leapfrogged over Douglas and ran for the presidency in 1860. What's left over is that most states in the United States, when there is a vacancy in the Senate seat, they have their governor appoint the person to follow. Now, there are a few states that have elections. There are a few other states that say the governor can appoint someone but must be from the same party as the outgoing senator. That way it doesn't change parties when a senator leaves. That's to make sure that senators, you know, can work in the executive branch without the party losing office. In this case, of course, Barack Obama has chosen a number of senators from seats where the governor is of the same party. That's true for Hillary Clinton of New York, for Joe Biden of Delaware, for Ken Salazar of Colorado, and also for Barack Obama, of course. Blagojevich, indicted though he may be, is a Democrat and appointed a Democrat in replacement. So at the end of the day, Illinois law says that the governor decides. And the Senate says, pursuant to a law passed in 1884, a Senate rule, that you have to have the signature of the governor and the Secretary of State of that state. It'd be interesting to figure out why they made that requirement. Maybe they feared that such things could be forged. Maybe they feared a corrupt governor. Who knows? I'm aware of no time in American history since this rule was passed when a Secretary of State refused to sign the governor's appointment. Why would he or she? Generally, a Secretary of State says, okay, governor, whoever you want to appoint, I'm signing. In this case, the Secretary of State did not. The Illinois Secretary of State, a man by the name of Jesse White, who happens to also be African-American, something that the Democrats are very quick to point out. Hey, we're not stopping Roland Burris. The Illinois Secretary of State is stopping Roland Burris. It's not our fault. He has to go outside in the rain. His own Secretary of State won't sign on. And that was true. But despite the fact that I'm sure Jesse White had good intentions, just as I'm sure that the Democratic majority in the Senate had good intentions, their good intentions were they didn't want to in any way reward a governor they all believed to be patently corrupt. The law is the law is the law, and Roland Burris is suing in the Illinois Supreme Court to require the Illinois Secretary of State to sign on, and you know what? I'm sure he will sign on. I suspect the Illinois Supreme Court will rule that he has to sign on, and, well, they will, and they're going to seat Roland Burris. Now, my solution would have been slightly different. I recognize the law. I respect the law. I think you have to seat the guy, and that's partly out of a case I talked about yesterday, the Adam Clayton Powell case of the 60s. But they could expel him. Clearly, under the Constitution, they have a right to expel him. It just requires a two-thirds vote of the membership. The Republicans were saying, oh, we're not going to expel because we want to have a special election. We want the Illinois state to change its law, the state of Illinois, to change its law and to make for a special election so that we, the Republicans, have a chance to grab the seat. The best option, of course, was for Governor Blagojevich to resign or be impeached and for the lieutenant governor, Democrat Peter Quinn, to make the decision. So the Democrats could have said, look, we're going to expel anybody Blagojevich puts forward, and Peter Quinn becomes governor, and then whoever he picks we'll keep. They could have done that, but to do that would require the connivance of the Republicans. It takes two-thirds to expel. And they weren't going to do that. It was going to get ugly. So finally, the Democrats just caved. All right, Roland Burris, as long as there's no evidence that you yourself have any personal scandal, come on in. And it looks like he will do. And again, I don't have anything particularly against Roland Burris, except to say that, well, he doesn't seem to be the most modest guy in the world. I don't think his policies are anything outside the Democratic Party or anything like that. But I do think that, I think that he's not, how do I put this? Well, he's not the most modest guy in the world. He's the one, of course, who has the mausoleum where he wants to put his name up there. He's already got this huge, massive stone structure where he mentions all of his incredible achievements, including the things like he was the first non-CPA to sit on an accountant's panel, which normally isn't the kind of thing for a mausoleum. And I guess he wants to add United States Senator to the mix. So Roland Burris will be seated. What about the others? Well, we talked yesterday at length. Coleman challenge is rendered gone by the Minnesota Supreme Court. I think that even though the Minnesota Supreme Court is majority Republican, that it's going to be really, really hard now that the votes have been counted to deny Franken a seat. Even in Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court didn't allow the votes to be counted, showing a Gore victory, and then install Bush. As Justice Scalia wrote on December 9, 2000, he said, if we count the votes, that will show Bush's win to be illegitimate, and we can't do that. I'm paraphrasing a little, but not by much. Not by much. He did say, if we count the votes, it will damage the legitimacy of George Bush's claim to be president. So I think that's pretty clear what he was saying. Anyway, in Minnesota, they counted the votes. And I don't know how you can possibly count the votes any possible way to allow Norm Coleman to win if you have any possible standard of counting where you apply the same standard to all the votes, Al Franken wins. Then again, if you applied any possible standard under any counting of votes, George Bush lost and Al Gore won. Still, I don't think the Minnesota Supreme Court is willing to do the coup d'etat that the United States Supreme Court did, if only because the stakes are so low. If you're going to do a coup d'etat, at least get the presidency for it, not a mere senatorial race. So I do think Al Franken will be seated. But that's not all for the turnover in the Senate, right? We've got a lot of other things to do. We have, of course, the vice president. Now, Biden is sitting in the Senate. He is currently a senator. If you saw It was Dick Cheney, the current vice president, who gave all the senators their oath of office, and that's because he is constitutionally the president of the Senate for at least 12 more days until we retire him to an undisclosed location. Anyway, Biden is sitting in the Senate now, and that's good. They probably could use his vote until on January 20th he resigns, and his replacement has been picked. His name? Ted Kaufman. Have you heard of him? Of course not. I hadn't either. I'd be shocked if any of you had heard of Ted Kaufman. Ted Kaufman is basically a staffer for Joe Biden. He's a longtime staffer. I guess it'd be kind of like if, I don't know, Barney Frank resigned and they picked me. I'd be happy about it. I'm sure Ted Kaufman will continue the views of Joe Biden over the next 2 years, but everyone knows he's a seat warmer. He's a seat warmer because Joe Biden's son, Bo Biden, currently who's serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think he's in Iraq, wants to run for the Senate. Why didn't they just appoint him? Well, because he couldn't get out of his tour of duty, believe it or not. You know, when you sign up for the military, you don't get to change your mind after you've signed up. He's still got a tour of duty. I don't know whether he asked the military to get out of it or not, but I suspect he knew they wouldn't let him. So they're filling it with a seat warmer for 2 years until Bo Biden can come back and win an easy election in 2010. I'd be curious to know what all think of that decision at 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I'm mixed. I don't really like the idea of seat warmers. I don't really like the idea of legacies. But Bo Biden is not just the son of the senator and the soon-to-be vice president. He is the attorney general of the state of Delaware, so he certainly held office. I don't know. I guess it doesn't bother me that much. But I'd be curious to know what you think about it. In terms of others that are running, in Colorado, we have Ken Salazar. Senator Salazar is going to be the Interior Secretary, and they replaced him with Michael Bennett. Michael Bennett is the head of schools in Denver and is yet another one of my classmates to have made it big in government. My jealousy, I admit, runneth over. I am green with envy. First came my classmate John Yoo, who came in the Office of Legal Counsel and made it okay, at least in his own warped mind, for the United States to torture innocent people and throw people in jail without trial forever. Michael Bennett, I have to say, is a good guy. He's on our side. He's a Democrat. He apparently has done wonders in Denver schools. I haven't seen him since I graduated either, and I wasn't particularly close to him, but I remember him being a nice guy, and I'm glad to see that he's going to be a senator from Colorado. Like I said, all I am is jealous. Excuse me, but I am. The real intrigue, though, over the filled Senate seats has to do with the Senate seat from New York. There is one more Senate seat to be filled. Senator Hillary Clinton will become the next Secretary of State. There's no question she'll be confirmed. And then the governor, David Patterson, will have to make a choice to fill her seat. You recall that Governor David Patterson became governor because he was lieutenant governor when Elliot Spitzer had his own problems with the law. I'm going to get back to Elliot Spitzer, SEC chair, but we'll get to that in a moment. Let's talk about David Patterson. David Patterson is not only the first African-American governor of New York, he is mostly blind. He is legally blind. I think he's entirely blind in one eye and 95% blind in another eye. It's an amazing thing, really, that he can conduct business at all, having to do everything from listening and talking. Good for him. He also had his own scandals, I should say. David Patterson's done a lot, given his disabilities, including sex scandals and the like. But this isn't about David Patterson. This is about his choice for Senate. And there's lots of good candidates. There's a number of members of Congress in the New York delegation I would like to see him appoint. I'd be happy with a large number of them. I've always liked Jerry Nadler, the congressman of New York, maybe because I know him personally and have worked with him. But there are many, many other good choices. But the name that keeps coming up in the press, and I guess she can't help it given her famous name, is Caroline Kennedy. Caroline Kennedy, of course, is the sole living survivor of President John F. Kennedy. His son, John Jr., of course, was killed in a plane crash. And Caroline Kennedy seems to be a nice person. She has done some good fundraising. She has co-written a few books. It's not clear how much she wrote and how much her co-author wrote. I have no doubt she's a good person. I have no doubt she has good liberal views. But should David Paterson appoint her? Well, I got to be consistent here, and so it's hard. I've sort of said, well, I guess I'm okay with Delaware warming the seat for Beau Biden, picking Ted Kaufman. I got to admit, I'm a little squeamish about it. But I have to say I'm much more squeamish about Caroline Kennedy. Caroline Kennedy, if she were appointed, would be appointed solely because of her father. Beau Biden would have to win an election, and that's fair. Anyone that goes up for election and wins, well, they get the seat. That's the way democracy works. But Caroline Kennedy, to be appointed, when she hasn't held elective office, she hasn't done that much, as far as I can see, that distinguishes her from anybody else, and she'd be getting it largely because she's a Kennedy. And I just don't like that. I'm not a big fan of legacy politics. I certainly think George W. Bush would be, I don't know, drunk in a corner somewhere. He wouldn't be in a ditch because the Bush family has a lot of money. They would put him away, I'm sure, in some very fancy home where he could drink away his days. But he certainly would not be president of the United States if it were not for the fact that he was a son of a former president. And we've seen a lot of this kind of nepotism, as it were, in American political history. You know, Al Gore is the son of a senator as well. George Bush Sr. was the son of Prescott Bush, that famous Connecticut senator that had such a soft spot in his heart for the Nazis. We have long traditions in America, whether it's the Kennedy family or the Udall family or even Huey Long's family for the Democrats. On the Republican side, of course, there's the Bush dynasty, as well as Forbes and others who prey on their fathers and do well that way. Caroline Kennedy, sorry, I'd like her to win an election. I'd like her to win an election if she's that great a speaker, and I don't mean to be so down on her. It's not against her personally. I just think that, well, David Paterson has a lot better choices. But I'd be curious to hear what you think. 877-4-HEAD-ON. If you agree or disagree, you're always welcome to call. 877-443-2366. I also want to talk about the stimulus package that Barack Obama is considering. It's likely to be over $1 trillion. And already you can hear grumblings and mumblings from the Republicans. The same Republicans who got us in this mess. The same Republicans who supported getting rid of the regulation that led us to the economic crisis we have right now. The same Republicans who supported the bailout to the banks. The same Republicans who supported massive deficit spending, even in good years, mostly to places like Halliburton and to, let's face it, to giving the money to all kinds of corrupt people in Iraq. Now spending's too much. Even though Obama has said he's going to do it mostly in the form of tax cuts. And I thought Republicans love tax cuts. But you see, Republicans only like tax cuts when they can get credit for it. They're talking about being budget hawks again. They, the greatest spenders ever, are talking about cutting back on the surplus. Cutting back on the stimulus package, I should say. So I'm going to talk about that, too. I do want to hear from you. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right.
We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my Progressive Point of View, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. One of the things I like most about Barack Obama is he understands the economic crisis we're in, and he grasps what needs to be done. He's not afraid to level with the American people that we need to spend close to $1 trillion, and yes, increase the deficit in the process if we're going to escape a depression. He also understands that the much ballyhooed private sector is incapable of solving the problem by itself. As he just put it, at this particular moment, only government can provide the short-term boost necessary to lift us from a recession this deep and this severe. Even right-wing economists like Martin Feldstein acknowledge this fact. Basically, the private sector's punted. The banks and the investment houses created the crisis by gambling on unregulated derivatives, and then even after Paulson dropped $300 billion into their laps, they refused to lend and refused to refinance mortgages. So we've got a credit crisis, a housing crisis, rising unemployment, and falling consumer spending, which in turn will cause more companies to throw more people out of work. Meanwhile, state governments are also in deep holes and are having to cut payrolls. This is the vicious cycle that only the federal government can solve. In less than 2 weeks, we'll have a president who gets that. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
The Inside Scoop and the calm before the storm, just 11 days and 19 hours to the end of the Bush presidency. And already the Army is doing its best to get all its work done before its new commander-in-chief comes in. One of its grim tasks, of course, is to send to the family members of people who've died letters saying to them how sorry they are that their relatives have died in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so the Army, just this week, sent out 7,000 letters addressed, Dear John Doe. No, really, addressed, Dear John Doe. I didn't even know that there were 7,000 family members of John Doe. I didn't know John Doe had lost his life. Neither did the family members, who were not pleased to see that the Army hadn't even taken the time to substitute the name John Doe for the real people who had died. I guess in an administration where funerals are not allowed to be shown on television, an administration where the people who die in our Army appear just cannon fodder, well, they just couldn't take the time. Can you imagine? Dear John Doe. Does nobody read these letters before they're sent out? thousand of them? Well, there's obviously an answer. They were form letters. No secretary could look at that letter, seal it, and send it out. They were sent by machine. Sent by machine. Rubber stamped. You know, I know back in the days of World War II, when we had many, many more people in arms and many more people dying, they would actually visit family members personally. It was an awful assignment. But the people who did it understood how important it was to have a personal representative, and let's face it, widows and mothers were scared to death to see a saluted Army officer outside their door with a folded American flag. But there was a comfort in knowing that their government at least cared enough about them to tell them in person their son, maybe daughter, usually son, or husband, had died. Today, at least they send a letter, right? They just send it out to John Doe. Can you imagine? Can you imagine losing your husband, losing your wife, losing your son, losing your daughter, and getting a letter? Dear John Doe, can we possibly get rid of this president soon enough? Meanwhile, other Republicans are having their travails. There are not that many Republicans in government anymore, thank God, but there are a few left, including the governor of Missouri. The governor of Missouri has deleted or otherwise destroyed millions of his emails. And in fact, he has been ordered by a court to share those emails. He has refused or has been unable to do so. What's interesting about this story is not that some Republican governor is covering up what he did in office. I think that's pretty common. What's interesting is that he's charging Missouri, the state of Missouri, for his legal troubles. You know, I remember when Bill Clinton was impeached, and as much as I opposed that impeachment, he hired private lawyers to defend him. Nope, not Matt Blunt. Matt Blunt says that not only am I going to do a cover-up, but I'm going to make the taxpayers pay for it. Ah, Republican family values. There's something really beautiful about that. Meanwhile, what else is in the news? We can praise Colorado for having the first time in history an African-American lead both its House of Representatives and its Senate. That's never happened in American history. Interesting that it happened in Colorado and not in Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, or any of those other states where there is a very large African-American population. In fact, just 4% of Colorado is black, and yet you got to give credit to a state that really is looking beyond race and is simply bringing in the best people to be the head of their House and the head of their Senate at the same time. Other states have had an African-American lead one chamber. Colorado's the first to lead both. I'm going to get to Obama's stimulus package in a second, but I just want to talk about just a number of sort of random miscellaneous things, one of which has to do with Elliot Spitzer. Why do I raise his name? Well, I raise his name because I was looking carefully at Obama's SEC pick, his choice for chairman of the Securities Exchange Commission, a woman named Mary Shapiro. And Ms. Shapiro seems to be a reasonable person. She indeed, you got to give her credit. She was someone who recognized that the credit derivative swaps that have caused 90% of the massive economic crisis we're in, she was one of the ones who tried to regulate them several years back. She saw it before it happened. So she's certainly a strong leader of the SEC, but she's also someone who's been in the SEC for a while and, let's just say, doesn't cause too much fear in the hearts of people on Wall Street. I think she'll do a fine job. But I was thinking, who would I rather have there? And I was reading, as I am wont to do, reading history, and I was reminded of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first SEC chairman. The Securities and Exchange Commission began as part of a New Deal program under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, following the crash in 1929. And who did he pick? He picked Joseph Kennedy. Did you know that? I didn't know that. Maybe some of you did. John F. Kennedy's father, the guy who is the parent, the father of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy, the old bootlegger, the person who during Prohibition from 1919 to 1933 made a fortune off selling illegal liquor. How did he gain respectability? FDR appointed him head of the SEC. Now, why would FDR appoint a bootlegger, a very successful bootlegger, someone with a history of breaking the law, why would they appoint him to head the Securities Exchange Commission? Well, Roosevelt had a pretty simple explanation. He said, Joe Kennedy will know how to find the crooks. Joe Kennedy will know where the bodies are buried. These aren't exact quotes. But his point was, it maybe it takes a criminal to catch a criminal. It takes a bootlegger to watch all those people on Wall Street. Joe Kennedy had made a history and a fortune off knowing what the law is and trying to work his way around it. And he knew, and certainly FDR knew, that that's exactly what they do on Wall Street. They don't produce anything. All they do is use their financial shenanigans to try to figure out a way to make lots of money. And if there are regulations there, they're going to try to work their way around it. So he said, who better to give them the regulations but somebody who knows how to avoid them? Interesting. I don't know that kind of thing could happen today. But thinking back on what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did, I couldn't help but think who would be the best person to strike fear in the hearts of Wall Street. Someone who would literally make people shake with fear if they were breaking the law, if they had a Ponzi scheme, if they were selling derivatives that had no basis in reality, people who were claiming things were AAA rated bonds and stocks and things that actually had no value behind them, the Bernie Madoffs of the world, who would scare them the most? Well, an easy name came to mind. It's Eliot Spitzer. Eliot Spitzer, prior to being governor of New York, was attorney general of New York. And as attorney general of New York, I would dare say he did more good than any state attorney general in American history. Eliot Spitzer, as the mere attorney general of New York, made Wall Street firms tremble because he made them honest. He went in and he checked their books, and if they didn't do what they were supposed to do, he threw them in jail. Eliot Spitzer was Joe Kennedy on steroids. I can't get over the fact that I always liked the guy. I liked him when he was attorney general. I liked him when he was governor. Frankly, I thought he'd be a great candidate for president. And then we all know what happened. Eliot Spitzer paid a very expensive call girl, a prostitute. Now, far be it from me to defend prostitution, but he didn't use state money. He's a far cry from Blagojevich, right? Blagojevich is corrupt. Blagojevich is pay to play. Blagojevich is about bribery. Now, they got to prove it. Jeffrey from Louisiana schooled me yesterday. Obviously, they have to prove it in a court of law. So we'll wait till they do that. But Spitzer? What did Spitzer do? Spitzer, with his own funds, wasted $5,000 on an expensive prostitute. Was that a good use of his funds? Probably not. Okay, definitely not. Was it kind to his wife? No, it was very unkind to his wife. But in the scheme of things, of all the crimes in the world, is using a prostitute that awful? He didn't use state funds. He didn't disclose state confidences. I mean, look at a guy like Dick Morris, who, when he hired a prostitute, was actually telling the prostitute state secrets. That is dangerous. Hiring a prostitute, I got to say, while prostitution may not be a victimless crime in most cases, I have to think it was in this case. In most cases, prostitutes are dirt poor. Pimps take advantage of them. I would legalize it. I would legalize it. I would regulate it as it's done in some counties in Nevada, as it's done in the Netherlands. Check the women or men for diseases. Make sure they're safe. It's the oldest profession in the book. And like bootlegging, like alcohol, it's not exactly a good thing, but I think it's impossible to root out. In any case, Eliot Spitzer, yes, paid a call girl, $5,000. It's kind of hard to think of her as a victim. She willingly did it. She apparently was not starving. I'm not saying it's a good thing. What I'm saying is, I want to see Spitzer as SEC chairman. I do. I admit it. Maybe that's not politically possible. But we have a sitting senator in Louisiana, David Vitter, who also hired a call girl, not once, but several times. Okay, Spitzer probably did several times as well. And he's married, and he's a Republican, and he's from Louisiana. Now, are you telling me that New York has higher ethical values than Louisiana? Maybe. Maybe. Or maybe it's a Democrat who can't be seen with a prostitute, but a Republican can. I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's because we have all the sickly details of Elliot Spitzer. But I know this. I'm still curious to know how Elliot Spitzer got caught. He didn't use state funds. How did they catch the guy? How did they get a warrant? How did they monitor him? What reason was there to believe he'd done anything wrong? I know it's hard to feel sympathetic to a guy who shoots himself in the foot. And I admit, I'm not saying this for the sake of Elliot Spitzer. I mean, he was an idiot, granted. I guess I'm saying this for the America. I can't think of a better Wall Street regulator. Someone who knows exactly how Wall Street works. Someone knows exactly how the bodies are buried. Someone knows exactly what kind of games people play, what kind of double books people do. Someone who's not afraid to take it on the chin and to go really roughshod against the people who, let's face it, rather than paying $5,000 for a call girl, have cost this nation trillions of dollars through their greed. And I couldn't help but thinking back to old Joe Kennedy, Franklin Roosevelt's pick, the first SEC chairman in American history. You know, if Spitzer's crime, and I guess it is a crime, is a bad one, think about Joe Kennedy's crime. I mean, we would call him a drug dealer today. For 14 years, from 1919 to 1933, the importation sale of alcohol was absolutely forbidden, not just in Massachusetts, but throughout the United States, according to the Constitution. It was against the law. Did millions of people flout that law? Yes, they did, just like, let's face it, probably millions, or at least hundreds of thousands of men see prostitutes, right? There were the bootleggers had to have their guns ready. Like the drug dealers of today, the killing each other for turf was a lot more severe than the actual drugs they were selling. There are alcoholics. Alcohol does its damage. My point is this. Joe Kennedy, for 14 years, flouted a constitutional law. One that I think was wrong, but nonetheless, he broke it. Why there would be is not because Spitzer saw the call girl. That would just be an excuse. But because Republicans fear nothing more than a very aggressive Wall Street regulator. Right? There's nothing they fear more because they know that all their friends committing fraud, all the ones who give to Republican campaigns, the backbone of the Republican Party is busy committing fraud on Wall Street. The kind that are passing around these credit derivative swaps, which, yes, I don't care whether they're legal or not, they're fraudulent. When you sell something that you know to be worthless for a lot of money, that's fraud, in my view. So they wouldn't fear Spitzer. They wouldn't oppose him because of the call girl. They'd oppose him because he would be effective. They would just say it's because of the call girl. I don't know. I don't think Obama will try it. Of course not. He's already picked Mary Shapiro. I think she'll be fine. I don't know. It just gets me. I think he'd be a good pick. And maybe, just maybe, if he were discussed at length and refused to be nominated, then someone could say to David Vitter, well, you know, if you can't be nominated for being a prostitute, then David Vitter, you have to resign from the Senate as well. I don't know if you agree. 877-4-HEAD-ON. 877-443-2323. I do want to talk about the stimulus package, though, because that will be the first battle of the Obama administration. Obama is not willing to sacrifice all of the political capital earned on, you know, an SEC chairman. He's not willing to sacrifice it much on anything. He's, we all know that he picked Rick Warren to give the invocation. He's trying to reach out to everyone, even the homophobes. He's trying to reach out to the Christian fundamentalists. He's trying to reach out to everyone. He's laying low. He's saying one president at a time. He doesn't want to make any enemies. What's all that political capital for? Well, it's for the stimulus package. It's for universal health care. It's for all the things he ran on, whether it's helping the environment, maybe it's for labor. I'm not sure. But come January 20th, Barack Obama is going to stop accumulating capital, and he's going to have to spend it. He has accumulated it well. 82%, which is an amazing statistic, 82% of Americans approve of how Obama's done so far. Now, you might say, well, that's really easy. He hasn't been president yet. But I can't think. I guess we'd have to go back to September 11th when Bush had those kind of approval ratings. It's hard to imagine a president with that kind of approval ratings. In a country, well, let's face it, a good 15, 16% of people still think Dick Cheney's doing a good job. 20-something percent, low 20s, think that Bush has done a good job. 82%. But as Obama knows, the whole purpose of political capital, the whole purpose of getting high approval ratings is to spend it. And the stimulus package will be the first place he goes. Now, the stimulus package is going to be big. Estimates are it's about $1 trillion or so. That's a huge amount of money, one that I think most people would blink at if it weren't for the Bush administration having just asked for close to that sum, $700 billion, to bail out the financial services companies, the banks and AIG and all the different investment banks. It is a large amount of money. And yet, I was looking in the newspaper at the various deficits over the past few years. And even when Franken takes a seat, and it looks like it's not going to be for another couple months, this is a stimulus package that really needs to act right away, we are going to need one Republican to join in to stop us. Now, we might need two if Franken isn't seated in time. And if we don't get Lieberman, we need three. But I think we'll get Lieberman. So we need two senators. I'll tell you why that is. There's going to be 99 senators. We're going to seat Roland Burrs, I'm sure, very soon. And Franken won't be seated for a few months. We talked about that yesterday. And then 99 senators, they need three-fifths to have a filibuster. Three-fifths of 99 is 59.4. And according to Senate rules, you always round up. Wouldn't it be nice if we could round down and just say 59? So we have 58 Democratic senators, including Lieberman. And we have 58. That's right, 58. And you need 59 to stop the filibuster. Oh, I guess we're just one short. Sorry, I'm doing math on the fly here. That's a very dangerous thing when you're behind the mic. I guess I was thinking 57 was without Burrs. No. We have 58 without Franken. So, okay, we only need one more. Okay, that's good. So it won't really matter, I guess, once we have... 59 rounded up is 60. Oops. Excuse me. It's the danger of doing math in your head. 59.4 rounded up is 60. We have 58. That's what I thought. We need two Republicans to sign on. And there are not many moderate Republicans left. Really, the two senators from Maine are the best shot. Olympia Snow and Susan Collins. Olympia Snow is more likely to help than Susan Collins. The other possibility is Arlen Specter. Now, I've got my own problems with Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, particularly in the way he treated Anita Hill in the Clarence Thomas hearings. But Arlen Specter, for a Republican, is certainly moderate by their standards. He was one who opposed some forms of torture, even. How rare for a Republican. And he's also got cancer. He's probably retiring. He's someone who I think could afford to distance himself a little bit from his party. Another vote that might happen, I'm not sure, but it's not out of the question, strangely enough, John McCain. I think John McCain recognizes that he went way too far, way overboard, that he went to the right in his political campaign, not just by picking Sarah Palin, but on all his views from immigration to his flip-flops on the tax increases, the tax cuts of the Bush administration. John McCain, I think, may still try to retain his maverick identity. Maybe we'll get a vote from him. But we're going to need two. Probably it'll come from Colin Snow and Spector. And what we're going to have is Republicans claiming, oh, there go those tax and spend liberals again. We can't let them do that. We can't let them do that because they are the tax and spend party. They're showing the spend party, the spend and deficit party, and it's not going to be taxes. Probably Obama won't raise the taxes of those that earn over $250,000 for at least another couple years when the Bush tax cuts expire. It's just a question of deficit spending. And if you look at deficit spending through the ages, as I've done, you can see that every single time, without fail, Democrats have cut deficit spending and Republicans have increased it since World War II. Now, a very expensive war. But from then on, Harry Truman brought this country to a surplus. And Eisenhower brought us to a small deficit. Kennedy brought us to a surplus again. Johnson, we had a deficit. It's true. He had to finance the Vietnam War. But by the end of his term, we went back to a tiny surplus. Nixon brought us to a deficit. Ford brought us to a bigger deficit. Carter slightly decreased that deficit. Then, of course, the biggest deficit in modern times is under Ronald Reagan. Deficit as a percentage of our gross domestic product, as a percentage of economic activity. Bush had a high deficit. Clinton, of course, gave us the greatest surplus in modern times. And then George Bush Jr., George W., gave us an even bigger deficit than Ronald Reagan, the largest deficit since World War II. Well, people should know these facts. People should know that Democrats are the party of fiscal conservatism, that Republicans are the parties of big deficit, and he should. Any Keynesian economist, anyone who follows John Maynard Keynes knows that when you have times like these, when you have massive unemployment going up every day, when you have cuts in business investment, when you have cuts in productivity, when you have cuts in consumer spending, when you have people watching their wallets, restraining themselves, when you have a credit crunch, when you have bank money out, there's only two levers that we have. I mean, it's basic macroeconomics 101. One is fiscal policy, the Federal Reserve. They can lower interest rates. And right now, the Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates from 3% to 2% to 1% to 0.5% to 0.25% to, get this, zero. Zero. The Fed will give you, if you're a bank, money for free. All they ask is that you pay it back, no interest. Now that's never happened before in modern American history. Zero. Borrow $100 million, just give us back $100 million. In other words, they have their pedal to the floor. Monetary stimulus is to the floor. They can't go any faster, and the economy is still sputtering. The only way out is to do exactly what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did. It's to do a New Deal. It's to spend massive money, but to spend it on the right things. You know, when you spend money building bridges in Iraq, it helps a few people in Halliburton. But that's pretty much that. It just doesn't go very far. But think about when you build a bridge here at home. Think about that bridge that collapsed in Minnesota. When you build a bridge here at home, not only do you give jobs to people here at home who then spend that same money in American stores, and then those store workers get, they spend their money in the car shop, and then the mechanics get more money, and they spend it in the rest, so on and so on. But you actually build something useful. You actually build infrastructure. What's amazing is America used to be at the head of infrastructure. We are the country that built the car. We are the country that invented the plane. We are the country that invented the jet engine and put it in mass production. Now we're falling far behind. The fastest bullet trains in the world, well, you can find them in Japan, in China, and in France, but not on our nation's slow rails, where they can't even go as fast as a car.
In every major European and Asian city, you simply hop on a speed train from the center of downtown to the airport. Where can you do that in America? Not too many places. You ever try to take a cab to New York's LaGuardia Airport or John F. Kennedy? You ever looked around at our train stations, at our bridges that are falling apart, at our roadways? Have you been to another country? Have you seen how well they're doing? Why are we falling so far behind? It's not just in bridges and tunnels and train stations. It's in the way we make cars. Here we are bailing out GM, which I understand has to be done for the workers' sake. But at the same time, we have to require GM and the American automobile manufacturers to move into the 21st century to develop an electric car. Already there's a factory, and it's already set up shop in Canada, Australia, and Israel. And this factory makes electric cars. And you know how you buy your electric energy? They get it from solar and wind panels. The safest, cleanest energy on existence on the planet, the sun and the wind, of which we have in abundance. And they make it part of energy, and you go and you buy that energy just like you'd buy an iTunes. You go on the internet, you purchase so many credits, and boom, it's there. You go on your credit card, you fill your car with this electricity. I'm not sure how it works. I'm not an engineer, but I know that it works. And it's going into mass production in 2011 with, of all companies, Nissan. Where's GM? Where's Ford? Where's General Motors? President Obama, he will be remembered, I think, as the first president of the 21st century. Bush will be seen as the last president of the 20th. It is his job to bring us into the 21st century with technological innovation, with massive stimulus spending, spending on the right things, not the wrong things. Now, hope you enjoy the Inside Scoop. I will see y'all next week when I debate Mike Lane, your favorite Republican, on some of these issues. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Oh.
You know, if this wasn't radio, if this was video, I'd put up that black and white image of that Indian in a war bonnet in profile with all the, you know, video calibrating gizmos around it, and maybe send a little 1 kilohertz tone, you know. Technical difficulties. Please do not adjust your set. Please stand by. Because that's kind of where we are this evening. I apologize to those of you listening, not for the content by any means, Mark was his usual wonderful self, but for the nature of the stream as it was going out to you, buffering and unbuffering and starting and stopping and
Okay, I confess. A lot of times when I'm sitting here producing Mark Levine's program, I may frequently be accused of also finalizing what I've done during the rest of the day as far as pulling together, you know, just what goes where in the evening show and what gets priority and what doesn't and what'll be fun and what'll give us a grin and what'll make us want to just do the sidelong sort of head bash into a wall kind of thing. So, I didn't get to do any of that. And I'll be quite candid with you. No, not tonight, Mr. HP update thingy. You don't get to update. Dadgum stuff's jumping around in the corner of my computer like a Jack Russell Terrier on acid. But at any rate, that's... That's just the tip of the iceberg. I got some really, really, really sad news about 3 hours ago. And I offer this by way of explanation if it seems like maybe I'm a little off my game tonight or a bubble off plum. I am. I got news that one of my sisters in Alabama died today. And it's a... We have all dealt with... Welcome to the planet. No one here gets out alive. We've all dealt with this sort of thing to one degree or another. And, you know, I've told you a million times or 100 times or perhaps 1,000 that the nature of what I do here is such that I have to be candid. And, I think this is CityNet calling in, so would you stand by for just a moment, please? I'm going to radio silence for a sec and see what they're doing. I'll come back.